Introduce Kai Carlson Z. Kai is a poet and filmmaker and a longtime Holdenite. True?
Very true.
I don't know how old you were when you first came, but you can share.
6 weeks.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know.
How was it?
It was a little different, but you know, same, but different. But.
Yeah. And we're so thrilled he's on faculty for 2 weeks teaching poetry and for 3 sessions. And tomorrow night we'll be sharing his poems and films right after Vespers and Clare's. And a book for sale in the store. And we'll be doing book signing on Monday too. So thank you, Kai.
Of course. My pleasure. I'm honored to be here to be talking to you guys today. Everyone get a handout?
Yep.
Got a handout, everyone? All right. What we're looking at today is broadly the topic of journeys. And, you know, this includes spiritual journeys, inner and outer journeys, hikes, you know, around Holden, road trips, various iterations of that idea. You know, I was a little nervous thinking about this subject at Holden Village because it's just too obvious. It's like we're all here on a journey already, coming from Seattle and then back, or in the Midwest and then back. There are some people from Slovakia here right now, Texas. Anyone here from Texas?
Yep. Yes.
All right.
Yep.
Longhorns.
Yep.
But really just Holden, part of the idea of Holden, the concept of Holden involves journey, and it takes a journey to get here and it takes a journey to return. You know, there's this adventure aspect to journey stories. There's this idea of the self that is the agent of change, but really, what all these stories include and what they tend to focus on is the transformation and the way that personal transformation transforms the larger community later on. So we're going to be looking at poems, and then we're going to do some free writing at the end. But first, I just wanted to kind of talk about some of these ideas and hear from people in the room, people that are here. So if we could just go around real quick, and if you could say your name and where you're from, or where you're journeying here from. Just kind of want to get a sense for the room.
I'm Julie
Van Frickenborn,
and we're from Anacortes, Washington, which is about an hour and a half north of Seattle.
And I'm Mike Van Frickenborn.
I am Arielle Udell. I am originally from Massachusetts, but now living in the Twin Cities.
That's cool. Yeah. Minneapolis.
Grace Copley from Edmonds, Washington.
I'm Claire Hansen, originally from Chicago, now living outside Seattle.
Seattle, okay. Yeah.
I'm Aaron, from Indianapolis.
Nice.
I'm Gabe, and I'm coming from Denver.
All right.
Rainey Naden from Squim, Washington.
And Denise Naden from Squim, Washington.
Great.
And Murray Lee from Minneapolis, and Kai's dad.
Mm-hmm. And the Hike House guy.
The Hike House.
For lack of a better term.
With a bear.
Yeah.
I'm Patrick Brady. We're from Seattle.
All right.
Joseph.
Yeah. Sorry, what?
Julie Joseph.
All right. Julie.
Anita Salmon from Austin, Texas.
Texas.
I'm Cindy Devereaux, and I am from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
All right.
I'm Candace Collins, and I'm from Austin, Texas.
All right.
Tamara White, Gallup, Washington.
Sarah Pitcher from Chicago.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Scott Brentz, Camino Island, Washington.
Sydney Roscoe, Seattle.
All right. And then, did new people come in here?
Yeah, I came in, I'm from Edmonds, Washington.
Edmonds, okay. And your name?
Tom.
Tom.
Tough question.
We'll get a little more complicated here.
I'm Daniel from Everett, Washington.
Right? And then.
Mogo Vida from a number of places, but right now the Bay Area in California.
Yeah.
And I'm Chris Hughes from Arden Hills, Minnesota.
And Kristen Hughes, also from Arden Hills.
All right, well.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'm Beth from Bothell, Washington.
All right.
I didn't say.
Yeah. And then one more in the back.
Okay, I'm Allison.
Allison.
Oh, Fishers, Indiana.
Fishers, Indiana. Some people from Indiana, surprisingly, somehow. A lot from Minnesota, as expected. Washington. It's just nice to kind of hear all these different places and realize that we're all just coming together in this space and time. And you guys saying that just kind of made me think of one of those maps on an airplane, the kind of with all the lines coming in and converging at the one point. It's just kind of a special thing to have so many people from so many different places gathered together in one effort to explore faith together. I guess just to introduce myself, I know Sharon said a little bit, but I started coming up here when I was a little kid. My parents used to be on teaching faculty every other summer, and we'd come up here, and I was one of these little village kids running around causing trouble. And some of the first introductions that I had to poetry and creative writing were sessions like this, where I just stumbled in, or I came because my dad was going anyway, and got introduced to some of the poets that I still read today, and some of my favorite poems. So it is an honor for me to be here on teaching faculty doing this. I've been coming up for many years as lead cook, and spent a year up here in 2007 doing that, and this is my first year on teaching faculty, so it's just a weird journey that I'm going through here of my own. Just to jump in, I want us to get like the foundation of Journey Stories and kind of get an idea for how I'm coming at this. Just to like think about it as a group, why do we like Journey Stories? What do they mean to us? How do we encounter them in our daily lives? Yeah.
The narrative of a journey story allows you to plug in bits of your own life, and it's moving and it has energy, I would say.
Yeah.
A journey story makes sure hardship means something.
Sorry, what?
A journey story makes sure hardship means something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way to think about it.
Journey stories help us find things that we have in common with other people.
Right. Encountering strangers, the unknown.
I think they often also take us someplace that we haven't been. So by reading, we can vicariously cover new territory, and internally and externally.
Yeah. And where do we encounter these? How do we have these stories told in a contemporary way in our culture?
YouTube videos,
yeah, that's one thing, for sure.
When you talk with other people who are the travelers, they come in family stories,
yeah.
When you're living in a senior community, and you hear this, some of the same stories often.
What type of story do you tend to hear?
Sort of any story. I have a rule that says you can't say to someone else, "Don't say that. I've already heard that story," because it's different every time.
Right.
And it's meaningful to the person who's telling it, no matter how many times they've told it.
Right. even if it has some fundamental similarities. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think they're often some of the first stories we ever hear. A lot of folk tales, nursery tales, many of those are dirty stories. And Disney movies, like the first things we encounter when we're kids.
Totally.
I was going to say film. I'm not a scholar of world cinema, but it seems like a uniquely American thing, the road trip movie.
Right.
That's a pretty common trope.
Totally. Movies, family, origin stories. Yeah.
I listen to The Moth. It's a storytelling podcast. And I just love it, and I think a lot of those same things come up there, and I guess one reason that makes me mention it, though, is that it's a podcast where the story is being told, it's rehearsed, but it's told organically, and it's a relationship between the teller and the audience, and I think there's something interesting there, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How, like you were saying, about how it changes, you know, when it's being told to you, or it's really interesting.
Yeah.
One of my favorite children's books is Tell Me a Story, Mama. And the it's a African-American child and her mom. And she's, Tell Me a Story, Mama. Tell me a story about the time you and Grandma went to the zoo and you saw an elephant for the first time. And then the child tells the story over and over again. So it's passing on, it's really passing on family heritage and storytelling as an art.
Right. Yeah. Well, origin stories often involve journeys and often involve these things. And, you know, when you look across cultures, there's a number of people, anthropologists and mythologists, that have isolated a story called the monomyth, Hero's Journey, that was popularized by Joseph Campbell in the 60s, 70s. And the thinking behind that is just that foundationally in a lot of cultures and in a lot of these different stories, there's a structure that's the same across all of them. And people know the monomyth, hero's journey kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, Joseph Campbell kind of isolates 17 distinct things that have to happen in these stories. Or that tend to happen in these stories, but the basic structure is that there's a protagonist and they are sort of called to quest and they go out on a journey and they encounter the unknown and are somehow changed or transformed by this encounter, and then they return home and kind of share that knowledge or whatever, that change, with the community. And this is, as you pointed out with the Disney story and the Disney movies, this is what a lot of films are based on, this structure. Think about Star Wars. It's just point by point, like the hero's journey. Any road trip movie, you know, lots of police movies, a lot with like a very driven adventure themed plot, have this kind of monomyth as a structural thing. And if you study screenwriting, you learn this right away, that this is one of the tropes, one of the kind of foundational scripts that people tend to use. The basic idea is very simple, and it's just somebody goes out, is changed, and then returns. And I just want us to look at some of these quotes that I have on this page, if you look at your packet. We'll talk a little bit about them later on, but I just want to get these ideas out in the air so that you can think about this from a couple different angles. The Tolstoy quote at the top, all great literature is one of two stories. A person goes on a journey, or a stranger comes to town. We'll talk about that one in a second. Anyone else need a packet?
Thank you.
Campbell's monomyth, which I just mentioned. A hero ventures forth from the world of common day into a region of supernatural wonder. fabulous forces are there encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow man. Anais Nin, we travel, some of us forever, to seek other states, other lives, other souls. Louise Glick, who's a poet and sort of a friend of mine, we have a weird relationship. She doesn't talk to me that often, but she like will nod her head at me occasionally. We look at the world once in childhood, the rest is memory. It's interesting, we'll think about that a little later. Walt Whitman, not I nor anyone else can travel that road for you. You must travel it by yourself. It is not far, it is within reach. Rainier Maria Rilke, the only journey is the one within, which this, you know, series is named after. A little quote from the Bible, Luke 4:1, Jesus, full of the Holy Spirit, left the Jordan and was led by the Spirit into the wilderness, where for 40 days he was tempted by the devil. He ate nothing during those days, and at the end of them he was hungry. The devil said to him, if you are the Son of God, tell this stone to become bread. Jesus answered, it is written, man shall not live on bread alone. So a number of the ideas there, some about the inner journey, some about kind of mythological journeys, some about memory. In looking at the Tolstoy quote, to begin, all great literature is one of two stories, a person goes on a journey, or a stranger comes to town. What does he mean by that? I'm always like skeptical of statements like that, all great literature, but...
They're stories about people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stories about people.
There's an axiom that I don't know where it comes from, but change your geography, change your life.
Yeah.
And I think that both sides of that quote fit that.
Right.
Axiom.
I like that.
Not many of us would be inclined to pick up a book that was about someone going through their daily routine that never changed, and that was the story. And that there's nothing captivating or appealing. What's the mystery of the book?
Right.
And it's the adventure.
That's Seinfeld. Which is funny sometimes, but...
When a stranger comes to town, he brings something with him or herself.
Right.
And how that can affect everybody that he or she comes into contact with.
Right.
And then that can change those individuals' lives.
Yep.
I think it's kind of just two sides of the same coin, saying the same thing. A person going on a journey will inevitably be a stranger going to the town.
Right.
Coming to the town.
They will be the strangers coming to town.
Yeah. That's kind of the joke of this quote, actually, which you're like just nailing. But it's the same story. It's the same story depending on the perspective that you take.
Right.
And the reason I think that this quote still exists, or that, you know, Tolstoy felt like this was what indicated a great literature, is that it highlights the an agent of change, right? That's the critical thing. Either somebody's going on a journey and they're changing by encountering the things, or you have a fixed place like Holden Village, long-term staff or something, and new people come in every week and it becomes a different community and it changes. So he could, you know, he could maybe just say all great literature involves change or involves transformation. But this has a little more mystery to it. But do you feel like strangers here at Holden? Or do you feel like you're on a journey yourself?
Yeah. First time here and learning, observing, you know.
Yeah.
I can agree with her on that. We were here the first time last year, and not knowing what Holden was all about was a learning experience. We're back this year.
Yeah.
And it still can be that way a little bit because Holden Village is, at least so far, the two times we've been here, are totally different.
Yeah.
The types of teachers, the types of programs that are being offered are different than last time.
Yeah.
So you can be a stranger the entire time. But
you don't feel like a stranger as much as you did the first time.
Because we are more, because we know what the atmosphere of Holden Village is, we are much more at ease to going up to people and just introducing ourselves and becoming, making new friends, making new relationships. So there is what you said, you can feel like a stranger, but at the same time, you can also feel friendship and family.
Yeah.
I'd also like to piggyback on what you're saying, because you're a part of a group that has placed yourself in the village and made intentional connections with everybody who walks by. And so if you're open to wanting to connect with other people, it's pretty easy to do because all you need to say is a couple words and all of a sudden the connection starts to happen. But it takes it's easier for an extrovert than an introvert, is all I can say, because it a little bit of effort goes a very long way.
Right.
And to piggyback on what you just said, an introvert can feel a little bit more relaxed once the extrovert goes out and brings them in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's this, you know, this village is sort of an experiment in this idea. When I've been here for short periods of time, I often will feel like a stranger coming to town. And it takes a little while to get your bearings and to meet people and everything, but if you're up here on long-term staff, you have the opposite kind of relation to that. And I'm kind of amazed that, you know, this community can go on like every winter with 100 people living together and like people don't end up killing each other at the end. It does get a little tense in April, but I think one of the things that keeps rejuvenating it and the reason people keep coming back to this place as a source of strength and a source of renewal is because it's constantly changing and we're constantly up here feeling that change. And you don't always get that feeling. You don't get as close to it in your daily life, but I think the fact that we're all coming here from someplace else and we know that this is sort of a midpoint in the journey. Some people, you know, between phases of life, some people come up here to renew faith, some people just because they got a couple weeks of vacation in the summer. But it's always, the experience here is always a piece of the journey, whether you're up here for a long time or a short time. But in thinking of this idea of sort of family, as already brought up, and otherness, I want us to just look at the Rumi poem that I have on the back of this page. And this is an often quoted section from a longer poem, but it goes, out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. So how does this little poem relate to journeys?
Can you tell us a little something about this author?
Rumi? Rumi was a Sufi mystic poet. If you've heard of the Whirling Dervishes, this was like a kind of Persian, a phase of poetry that was written in Persia a long time ago. I forget if it's, I think it's BC something, some hundreds of BC. But the whirling dervishes would spin around a pole. So they had a pole in the middle of a tent usually, and they'd spin around it holding one hand on the pole and one hand up in the sky. And the idea was that one hand was connected to the earth, one hand was connected to God or to heaven. And they would typically just dictate ideas that came into their head, just fragments, flashes, and they thought that they were getting language from God. And Rumi only exists as a poet that we still read because he had a really good friend that thought he was doing something interesting and just wrote down everything he said, he recited while he was spinning. But these dervishes would just spin until they were really dizzy. And the idea was to kind of, I think, distort the senses a little bit so maybe more honest language could come through.
I'm just going to say, you know, my travels to foreign countries, you have not as good a grasp as to, you know, what is considered right and wrong, etiquette, or even ethics. So, you know, going on a journey gives you an opportunity to maybe get a sense of what might lie beyond wrongdoing and right.
Right. Any other thoughts?
Well, going on a journey gives you a different perspective.
Right.
Journeys can be rich in both good and bad ways. The poem kind of, in just kind of presenting, you know, a little bit of fantasy kind of originally led me on to think of like something, you know, blissful and wonderful, but when I read it a second time, I don't really want to go down that route because I see it could be either way. It's just full. I think that's what journeys are.
What was the last word? Was the word? Full?
Full, yeah.
Full, yeah.
Rich, full.
Yeah.
I like the way he says, you know, out beyond the ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there's a field. And that's so concrete, like that the place that's separate from those two extremes is concrete, like in the lived experience. I think that's really interesting. I like that.
Yeah.
I think the last two lines, especially even the phrase "each other" doesn't make any sense. Kind of the sense that you cease to have a conception of otherness.
Right.
You feel a connection to everything in a way that you don't feel alienated from what's around you, and feel like you've absorbed what's around you in a way.
Right. There's often a moral component to journey stories, and that morality is sort of a reimagining of morality, you know, reimagining of what is right, what is wrong, what is proper etiquette. The crossroads is sort of a theme in a lot of like journey stories, especially music. You hear the crossroads mentioned as like a moral juncture in a lot of songs that are about this. But there's an encounter with the other and an attempt to empathize. And I think Rumi's trying to get at this idea that that there's a place beyond the physical world. There's a place beyond our rational minds and our attempts to make right and wrong out of everything. And it's maybe a mystical place or a spiritual place where souls can kind of commingle. But I think the attempt here is to find a space where that diffusion can take place. And it's interesting that he feels like he has to go somewhere, travel somewhere for that to happen. He has to go to a field where another person is going to meet him. And that's when that can take place. But he doesn't say, come to my house and we'll figure this out. but...
Well, maybe it's because he has to leave his comfort zone.
Right, right. Exactly.
I think this poem points out, too, that just the coming together and what is common in us all, I mean, that's what I take from it. You know, they're leaving ideas of, like you, somebody else said, extremes of thought, maybe, and coming to a place where everybody can agree or commune, I guess,
yeah,
in this field.
Yeah.
Would Rumi also say that that grassy space is right here within us at all times?
Probably. Yeah. He's been gone a while, so you can't ask him, but I think he probably would. So I want us to, we're going to talk a little bit about otherness and empathy and how we are changed by these encounters at the next session, but before we do a little free writing, what I want us to think about is how this idea can apply to our writing, namely our poetry, because you have an idea how this idea of the monomyth or the hero's quest or like the leaving and then coming back to the home can apply to plot and can apply to narrative structure, but in poetry and in journaling, it's a little more difficult to see. But poetry often revolves around what's called a turn. Anyone heard that term for a movement in poetry? It's often when a poem makes a shift and changes direction. That's one way to think about it. But from its origins, poetry has kind of been the idea of it being physically manifest in the world and involved in journeys has been there. Verse, the word that we used to use for poetry, comes from the Latin vertere, or verses, and that means to turn, as in the plowing of a field, as in a furrow in a field. So I think, you know, that term just manifested because people were farming fields a lot and they were thinking about the structure as similar. You walk across a field, you turn the plow and you move this way, and then you turn the plow again and you move this way, and that was called verse. And so the idea that it is a journey itself, a poem is a journey itself as you read it down the page, was inherent in the word, the language that we used to use for it. But this idea of the turn has stuck around. It's very important to contemporary poetry and how we read poetry. And I tend to think about it as an opportunity for the poem to open up and for the poem to allow change in the reader. And turns often happen when they happen, it's that kind of moment where you feel your kind of stomach falling out, or you feel the top of your head taken off, as Emily Dickinson said. But let's look at this Gary Snyder poem to just kind of see how this works. This is a hiking poem. People know Gary Snyder? He was often affiliated with the Beatnik writers. But he wasn't really he hung out with Allen Ginsberg and those people, but he was kind of the first eco-poet, one of the first eco-poets in America, and he did a lot of hiking and he worked as a kind of for the Forest Service, 16 trails on trail crews when he first started writing. And this one's from his first book. Mid-August at Sourdough Mountain Lookout. Down valley, a smoke haze. 3 days heat after 5 days rain. Pitch glows on the fir cones. Across rocks and meadows, swarms of new flies. I cannot remember things I once read. A few friends, but they are in cities. Drinking cold snow water from a tin cup. Looking down for miles through high still air. So what's the scene he's painting there?
One of separation.
Okay, yep. He's up on a mountaintop, looking down valley.
Smoky.
Smoke, fires. Thinking about his friends. Was there a feeling of where a turn might have occurred in that poem? A shift in direction? Yeah.
Just that second paragraph that completely talks about he doesn't remember things he read.
Right.
He's moving from the mountain to back with his feelings.
Right. Yeah, that's where it occurs. First stanza is all set in the real world, set in his, you know, kind of mode of awareness there. Then it moves to, I cannot remember things I once read. It's a big shift. Doesn't logically follow. But that opens up the poem to the new possibility that kind of develops in the second stanza. So, in thinking about the turn being there, and in thinking about this idea of going out, venturing out into the world, and then being changed, and then returning home, is there a way in which the poet is indicating the change that he's going through just by the structure of that turn? Maybe a leading question.
It's as if those things don't matter in that moment. Mm-hmm. He's letting them go. Or realizing their distance.
Right.
There's a juxtaposition between the beauty of the exact moment in mid-August and the long past, which he cannot remember details of.
Right.
Like a fast forward and a halt.
Right.
He holds attention to incredible attention to detail. Noticing the pitch on the pine cones, new flies, small stuff, and then so he's deeply in the moment.
Yeah.
Deeply present in where he is in nature. And the other things, like someone said, they're kind of foggy, they're distant, they're looking for miles away.
Right. Yep.
I think there's just a sense of simplicity to the first stanza where, like, he's noticing the things around them, but they're very simple, kind of objective facts.
Yeah.
This is where I am. And then the turn is sort of the introduction of the more complicated thought.
But, right.
You know, once he's kind of cataloged what's happening around him, transitions to thinking about, you know, more complex ideas and emotions.
Right.
I think he's old. And he's just so in the present now because these moments are precious.
Right.
And so he's just falling out of the present, stating that he's old, he can't remember things, and his friends are kind of in the past, and let's come back to the present where the glass of crystal clear water is pleasure.
Right. Yeah. I like that idea. What's the indication that the speaker has been changed? Is there an indication that the speaker's been changed?
The fire is like a phoenix.
Uh-huh.
It's burned up his past.
Yeah, you can think about it like that.
The drinking water from a tin cup.
Yeah.
It's just sort of out. I mean, there's something before it that's bigger, there's something after it that's bigger, but the sort of grounding in reality of the cold water.
Right.
In the middle of the.
Sounds good. Mm-hmm.
Right. It does sound good, but why do we think it sounds good at that moment?
Because it's hot for you.
Yeah, exactly. Because the first stanza is all heat. It's all smoke. It's all the unknown. It's confusion, or represents some kind of confusion. Swarms of new flies. It's a little ominous. What are the flies gathering on? Then he says, I cannot remember things I once read, exactly like the fire is burning up his past or eliminating it in some way, obscuring it. A few friends, but they are in cities. So now he's blasting off to like a distant locale. Back to the present, drinking cold snow water from a tin cup. Right? Mm-hmm. Suddenly he's cooled by this. Suddenly he's relaxed, calmed down, chilled out. Mm-hmm. And then he's looking down for miles through high, still air. There's a sense that there's clarity at the end because of this change. And it's, you know, a small poem. Not a lot is taking place, but it has this structural movement that you see in other journey stories. He's out in the mountains. He's encountering the unknown, something that kind of tests him. And that kind of turns him in a way that challenges him and changes him. And then we have the resolution of the return to the present. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
This is a technique you see time and time again in writing. Sometimes it's in paragraph structure, sometimes it's in poems, sometimes it happens multiple times throughout poems. But poets will often do this thing where they start in the present moment, or they start in narrative form, and then they move into the metaphysical. They move into something that's changing, and then they move back into the present, back into the physical world. And something is different now in the way they describe the physical world, the way their eyes have sort of adjusted in light of this shift. And the descriptions are different. That's how we feel this change that has taken place in him. And it's much more effective to do that than for him to say, you know, I'm really uncomfortable, I've been out on the trail for a while, I'm missing my friends, I just wish I could, you know, hang out with them. Yeah, I'm thirsty, right? That would be a less compelling poem. But I want us to just, with our journals or with our writing material,
that's good to me.
Just try to write a little poem like this. A small little journey poem. In which you do something like that. You do a kind of immersion in the present or the physical world up at Holden here, and then kind of move into a place that takes you psychically, metaphysically, and then again return to the present and see if there's a way in which you can describe the present differently. Anyone need pens? Paper, pens? Yeah.
Two pens.
Thank you.
I
people get something going there. You can always put a dash at the end if you don't have a finish. Emily Dickinson style. How was that? Was that helpful in any way? Anyone want to share what they wrote?
Did my wife just volunteer?
Yeah, I think so. Sorry.
It didn't happen. She can go next. So I just had a title, Holden Village, July 2019. So I wrote, dark, worn wooden chairs forming semicircles centered on a round rock hearth. Embrace my back through 30 years of down the lake and return, from one we to another, in this axis mundi around which my life has revolved. Mm-hmm. And because I came 30 years ago for the first time, and David Lee is a professor.
Right. I was wondering. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The circle of we.
The circle of we.
Wow. So my uncle was a professor at St. Olaf, and that's what he's referring to there. The baseball class.
Yeah, well, yeah, here it was like literature.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was great. Julie, is it?
Mine is not so fleshed out. It's very messy, too. But it's similar. This room with its wooden chairs, walking pads, circled around rocks. Those two in a circle. Everything circles. It's summer, dry enough to make me search my room for chapstick, even when I know I don't have time. Kids creating dust storms outside. Now two of those are mine. If I let my memory seep in, I can see this room, once full of hearts I knew. No strangers. Every chair was filled. He's gonna finish me. Sorry. It was winter then, and 15 years ago. But the paths are the same, and the rocks, and the circle.
Nice. I like that. The circle kind of became the idea. Yeah. So there were a couple turns in there. People feel those. Thanks for sharing that, Julie. Anyone have a feeling about where those turns were? Just thinking about that kind of structure.
Read it again.
Yeah, do you want to read it again, Julie?
No, I can't read it in the first time. He can.
There was a chronological term.
Yeah.
Started here, now, and then 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's when the emotion was
Yeah.
the memory.
Went inside to outside. Do you want to just read it?
Yeah, you read it.
This room with its wooden chairs, lumpy paths, circled around the rocks. Those two in a circle. Everything circles. It's summer, dry enough to make me search my room for chapstick, even when I know I don't have time. Kids creating dust storms outside, now two of them are mine. If I let my memories seep in, I can see this room once full of hearts I knew, no strangers. Every chair filled. It was winter then, and 15 years ago, but the paths are the same, and the rocks, and the circle.
That's lovely. Mm-hmm. That's great, Julie. I really, really like that. But do you feel how those turns create movement? Mm-hmm. create energy between these different pieces of time and allow for things to kind of come back. We start with the chairs, we depart, we go into search for chapstick, right? Mm-hmm. Some comfort that isn't able to be found, really. Kids running around dust storms, summertime, then we come back into winter, and we come back to the interior space again, and it does create a circle in that way.
As is, this is a circle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. Anyone else want to share?
I will. Out of my comfort zone, on a train through unfamiliar country, then a stop, a van, a boat, and a bus. Down a road that switches back and forth into the unknown. A place of wonder appears. New surroundings, new foods, new learnings. Conversation with people, both new and familiar. Lasting memories as I leave. Holden Village, now my place of comfort and challenge. And on to new unknowns.
Mm. Nice. I think we got some poets in the room.
Yeah. I've lovely. Never done this before. Right? I looked at it and I thought, it actually almost looks like a poem to me.
It sounded like a poem.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about
yeah.
this, if it's okay.
Sure.
Do you need to know what the shift is, or is it discovered in the writing? Like, I found myself trying to write about things that were rather hard, and
yeah.
I thought, well, I don't know what the other side of this shift is.
Right.
You know, almost trying to find wisdom.
Right.
And I guess I'm just wondering, like, what do you think about that? You know, or what do we think about that? Like, do we arrive at new insight, or do we have an insight, and then we try to write about it?
Right. Well, it's a good question. Writers often talk about this, but I've found personally that the unconscious mind is always more intelligent and more aware of what's being trying to be communicated in the conscious mind. And sometimes a shift like that, where you're kind of following your intuition to the next subject, creates a surprising connection or surprising juxtaposition that you didn't really know was there. But in the writing, in the process, it comes out. And we have these brains that are always attempting to make meaning, are always attempting to connect things. But sometimes, if you pull the connections farther apart, the meaning is even a little more clear, or it becomes a little more stark what's being communicated. And the rationale to try to make something logical or say something didactic often derails a poem instead of opens it up. But writing poetry is kind of a trick. It's not that hard. It's about being really in tune with your emotions and your surroundings, and then just getting lucky. Sometimes your brain does a cool thing and then you get a good connection and a good poem out of it. Yeah?
I would share.
Okay.
When I was thinking about change, though, I just went back to something in my life that was a big change. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that it necessarily is something that I used in the poem as a... Anyway, stuck behind the headboard, yelps led me there. He'd wandered into trouble again. Deaf, blind, devoted, childlike. We wept for 72 hours, the rain pelting his grave.
Hmm. Wow. That's powerful. Do you want to read it again?
Stuck behind the headboard, yelps led me there. He'd wandered into trouble again. Deaf, blind, devoted, childlike. We wept for 72 hours, the rain pelting his grave.
It's a little bit ominous, you know, it's a little bit unclear exactly what has happened, but I love the atmosphere that's created there.
The yelps is supposed to give it away that it's my dog.
Oh, I see.
The yelps led me there.
Yeah, okay, I see. Yeah. Yeah. Surprising, again, surprising turns. Anyone else care to share?
I'll share.
Totems stripped bare by flame stand majestic. Majestic still the ones that have fallen. Buds cling to steep rocks. Life has the last word. What new adventure will burst forth from the remains of all I thought I was? Admitting my death, all I can do to give birth to the one asking to be free and true.
Hmm. Nice. Mm. I like that.
Struck by the scene of the fire damage mm-hmm. on the boat.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And still how mm-hmm. powerful that was.
Right. And how that turned you inward mm-hmm. into this reflective space. Yeah. How did the description go at the beginning again?
Totems stripped bare by flame stand majestic. Majestic still the ones that have fallen. Buds cling to steep rocks, life has the last word.
Mm, I like that.
Mm-hmm. Life has the last word.
It's a great line that you end on there. Mm-hmm. And then the poem turns after that to mm-hmm. the inner space. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Yeah.
Collection of villagers clinging to a mountain, making a space for community among the pines and bubbling creek. The liftoff timer reaches zero. Engines roar with life, pulling away and apart, leaving little more than contrails and spectators. The gravity of place and people drawing closer, drawing nearer, recognizing the tie of creator, created, and creative, carved out of the mountainside.
Hmm. Nice. I love the way that we get the airplane, right? That was an airplane taking off.
Mm-hmm. Rocket and then something.
Something taking off, helicopter maybe. And then this idea of gravity as being a force that pulls people together later on. And it's just this juxtaposing kind of image set. Anyone else want to share what they wrote?
I'll share.
Yeah.
He has caught the morning dove. Her cage is shiny with little room to spread her wings. One morning she awakes to find a feather tip lonely on the paper obituaries. And loosens the door with it and finds the mountain. He wanted a mockingbird anyway.
Hmm. I like that. Can you read it one more time?
Mm-hmm. He has caught the morning dove. Her cage is shiny with little room to spread her wings. One morning she awakens to find her feather tip lonely on the obituaries and loosens the door with it and finds the mountain. He wanted a mockingbird anyway.
Hmm. Yeah, I like that term.
It has really nice imagery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He wanted a mockingbird.
Thank you. Anyone else feeling afraid? Easy target.
Trying not to make eye contact.
Hang on. I thought I was going to a picnic. Someone's farewell at Powerhouse Park. I don't remember whose. The news came, your daughter, Caraway. My knees weak, unable to stand. I sat on the parking lot asphalt.
Yeah. That's a quick going out and coming back. All hinging on that one line, that one turn. What's one of the things that this kind of technique or this idea, at least in a poem, allows for?
A surprise.
Yeah.
A question?
Mm-hmm. You can see it like that too.
It feels like a lens that zooms in and out.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's a good way to think about it.
Yeah, that's a comparison between what was before the break and
right.
What's after it.
Right.
That's mm-hmm. Two lenses.
Yeah. Yeah. In when you write prose, one of the ways that you create drama, one of the ways that you create tension and effect on the audience is by counterpoint and juxtaposition, and you can do this very effectively in plot. People do this all the time. If you're making a film, you can, you know, use contrasting colors to kind of make things set against each other or in line with each other. But in poetry, sometimes it's harder to pick up the techniques or the mechanics behind these kinds of things. But just in hearing these examples here, what we wrote in, 10 minutes? You could feel the energy that was created by starting in the present, or starting in the real world, moving outward, then coming back. And that difference, that ability to hold those two things in contrast with each other, creates a tremendous amount of tension and energy in a poem. Often I feel like people have a hard time figuring out how to create a really intense, powerful impact in poetry. And you read some poems that just have that one line or that last thing or that image or that turn that just knocks your socks off. But this is just one method of kind of getting toward some of that territory. And I hope you can kind of use this idea as a license to move between experiences and, you know, move between worlds and ways of being in the world. But thank you all for sharing, and thank you for being here in this space, being willing to write a little bit.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for inspiring
us. Yeah.
Of course.
Thanks for a bunch of poems to read.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
these are good.
We're going to be talking more in depth about all these things on Thursday and Friday, looking a little more closely at the poems that are in the packet and thinking about other aspects of journey stories and what those can open up in our own poetry. But on Thursday, we're talking about otherness, encountering the unknown, encountering strangers, and a little more about that Tolstoy quote. And then on Friday, we'll talk about the return home to community and how these kind of personal journeys can then enlarge and enrich our larger communities. Mm-hmm. So come back if you want. Want to do some more writing. Tomorrow night, I'll be showing a short film and reading some poems from my book that just came out this last year. And it's sort of the book is kind of a journey book. It's a lot about train hopping and hitchhiking and stuff.
Is journey something that you came to as a kid, as a young adult, because you were train hopping and the whole idea of journey?
Well,
where did that come
from? Honestly, a big part of it was coming out to Holden every year. My parents, as I mentioned, like taught out here New Testament stuff, Luke and Mark.
And Old Testament.
And Old Testament, yeah. Well, probably a lot of different things. But we would always load up the family van. I grew up in Minnesota, and we had one of those big, like, wood paneled vans. It was like maroon, I think. Had that fake veneer on the side. And one of those sliding doors that always like slams people's hands in it. They don't make them like that anymore, thankfully, but that's what we had. And we just drove across the country camping along the way. And we'd go to the Badlands and Devil's Tower and like all these points out west. And Holden Village and Seattle and the Pacific Northwest, this was also like in the 90s when Nirvana was kind of happening. And I remember coming to Holden when I was young and just seeing all these people juggling on the green, you know, wearing Pearl Jam shirts and playing guitar and, you know, being a little bit out there in ways. And it was just really inspiring. It was just an idea that I got in my head that I kept coming back to, just the journey out west and this other reality than Minnesota, which, as you know, some of you from Minnesota can be kind of bland sometimes, especially in the winter. But yeah, I think that that sort of got me interested in that idea and in journeys. And then when I graduated from college, I went through a pretty serious depression and had a hard time, you know, keeping a job and doing the normal responsible things that I felt like I was supposed to be doing. And I started hitchhiking and just traveling around the country and sleeping on friends' couches, and eventually started hopping trains and doing that kind of thing.
When you say hopping trains, do you mean hopping into a boxcar?
Yeah, basically. Like that, I mean,
that really hopping trains.
Yeah, people don't hop boxcars anymore, but that same kind of idea.
Even in the 90s?
Well, this was after the 90s.
Wow.
I'm older than you would think.
I mean, I didn't realize, you know, it'd be that late.
Oh, yeah. Well, in the 90s, honestly, late 80s and early 90s, it was kind of the heyday for train hopping. Because it wasn't very, like, one of the things was the president of the NSF said we're not going to like prosecute any train hoppers. So there was a gang that traveled on the BNSF lines, trafficking drugs and murdering people and all kinds of weird stuff. That doesn't happen anymore, I don't think, but it was so available then that it was just sort of a wild territory.
What did you ride on then? I mean, I know the old boxcar mm-hmm. story, but what?
Well, you ride in what's called wells. You ride in, if you look at, you see those container cars, container trains that are stacked up. At the front and rear of those containers, is a little well that's about like 3 feet deep, 8 feet wide, and you just sit in that thing and hope you don't get rained on. But there's a lot of crouching involved. If it ever was, it's not the, you know, 12 guys in a boxcar playing the banjo and drinking whiskey anymore.
It's not the romanticized version the movies.
Right, exactly. The film that I made with my brother Anders, who also has been up here a lot, he hop trains with me periodically, and we made this film together, and we did make kind of romanticized version of it. We left out all the bad stuff, but that'll be playing tomorrow. It's kind of a fun film.
What time?
8 o'clock after Vespers. But thank you all for being here, for sharing, and for being willing to think about some of these ideas of poetry and journey stories. It's been kind of an honor to just be able to talk to you about this stuff. You got to learn to.
Thank you.